This is Monday, November 21st, 2011. This is George Cusis, graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin, H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical, Culture, and Sports, Institute for Olympic Studies. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing swimmer Jane Swaggerty over the phone about her experiences at the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. And just to kind of get things started, can you please state your birth name and when and where you were born?
Okay, born Jane Ellen Swaggerty in Oakdale, California.
Now, did you grow up in Oakdale as well?
No, it was actually the nearest hospital when I was born. We lived in another town, and that was the closest hospital. But I actually grew up in Stockton, California, and that's about 45 miles south of Sacramento.
And could you just talk about your childhood a bit? What sports were you doing from a young age?
Okay. Well, I actually lived about three houses away from a local swimming pool. We lived in a homeowners association. So my family, all my brothers and my sister, we all learned to swim because it was just right down the street. So I grew up in the summers going to the pool every day. As soon as the pool opened at 1 o'clock, we were all lined up ready to go swim. And I learned to swim when I was about 5 years old. And my first race was the 15-yard freestyle. They put a rope up in a 25-yard pool, so we only swam to the rope since we were so young. But, you know, I do remember those childhood memories of, you know, going to the pool in the summertime. It was warm in the summer in Stockton. And so the pool was a really fun place to be, and, you know, grew up doing that. And then in school, in my grammar school, you know, they had the kickball and, you know, all the other different sports they have at school. But other than that, all I did was just basically swim in the summer.
Did you have any siblings?
Yes, I have an older sister who's 6 years older, an older brother who's 3 years older, and then my younger brother was 3 years younger than I am.
Were they swimmers as well?
Actually, all of us were swimmers, yes. Yeah. When we grew up right there near the swimming pool, you know, we all swam in the summer leagues. And then the coach, his name was Kelly Kelson. His father was Chris Kelson, who was a rather kind of a prestigious coach at University Pacific in Stockton. The pool at the University Pacific is named after him. Anyway, his son Kelly was my coach, and he left to go coach at another pool. And so I changed swim teams, and we belonged to the West Lane Tennis Club, which was much further away, but it was a family, you know, tennis club, swim club. And, you know, I continued swimming there during the summers and stuff until I was about 12. And then I started swimming year-round because I was having to compete against swimmers in the Bay Area who were swimming year-round. And for me to keep up with them, I had to, you know, start swimming not only just in the summer. I had to swim in the you know, school months, in the winter, and continue on that way. So my brothers and my sisters sort of at that time sort of decided, well, you know, they didn't want to continue on with swimming quite so strongly. My older brother did swim in college, and he was also a water polo player and coach when he was going to college. And then my sister, she stopped swimming, I think, when she was about 16. So we all grew up around the pool and enjoyed it, and it was part of our, you know, family life. And actually every weekend seemed to be a swim meet. Mm-hmm. And my father would always say, you know, when are we going to go on vacation? Every weekend we're at a swim meet. And so it was, you know, it got to the point where, you know, it was very time-consuming because my parents were involved with being timers or judges at the swim meet. So it did involve the whole family.
Sure. Were there any major influences that you had early on in your career?
Well, when I was 10 years old, I remember watching the 64 Olympics, and or the 1960 and the 64 Olympics, and then, you know, I was just so enlightened by the whole thing, and Donna Deverona was sort of my idol. I just thought, gosh, if I'd really like to go to the Olympics someday. And I think she was the youngest swimmer on the 1960 team, and then in 1964, of course, she won two gold medals. So I always sort of looked up to the older swimmers that were doing really well, and I excelled in my local swim clubs and my local swim meets in Stockton, and then, of course, I was swimming in the AAU at that time. The Amateur Athletic Union is now USA Swimming, but I had to, I was sort of a big fish in a little pool, you know, a little pond, so to speak. And then when I had to swim in the Bay Area, of course, I was swimming against the tougher swimmers, and I had to train differently, and, you know, just my whole perspective of swimming changed because I realized that I had to compete at a different level. But during this time, I was still swimming for West Lane Tennis Club with one coach, and I was actually swimming in AAU unattached, so I really wasn't with a swim club as such, because there really were no other members of our team that were swimming at my level.
Mm-hmm. Was there much high school swimming in the area, or was that kind of...
There were no high school swimmers for girls. It was all boys.
Okay.
There were no girl swim teams, and there were a lot of no girl, a lot of things. there was no Title IX. You know, that started in 1972. So this was all pre Title IX. Your basic amateur, swimmer.
Mm-hmm. Now I guess just moving more towards your Olympic career, obviously you weren't in college yet, so take us back to kind of the year leading up to the games.
Sure. Well, I was at the West Lane Tennis Club, and again, I was the only one swimming in a national competition. I would travel by myself, or not by myself, I would travel with my coach, or my parents, you know, would take me to the various clubs to swim in the Bay Area, but then I would go to the Nationals. I went with a couple of swimmers from my team, actually, to the Nationals, but there was a big blow-up at the tennis club because my coach needed to have more pool time, and the manager of the club wanted to have more pool time for the recreation swimmers, so it was sort of my coach was saying, it was sort of like, you know, I quit, you're fired, excuse me, type of a situation. So I was left without a pool and without a coach, and it was 1967. It was the year before the Olympic Games, and my dad, you know, sat down with me and said, you know, Jane, it's probably a good idea to stop swimming. And I said, no, I really want to try. I have, you know, it's a year before, I have one more year to try. And the only way that I had a chance was to actually move away from my home and live with my aunt and uncle, who lived in San Jose, California, and I would be training with the Santa Clara Swim Club, which was about a 20-minute drive on the freeway from my aunt and uncle's house. And so my parents talked to my coach, and then they also talked to George Haynes, who was the Santa Clara Swim Club coach at the time, who had been the Olympic coach for 1960 and 1964. And Santa Clara was the hotbed for swimmers. It was, you know, people from all over the world would come there to train with George. And you had to have a place to live and have, you know, secure family life. And you had to have, you know, a real desire and a good chance of making the Olympic team before he would accept you on the team.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up living with my aunt and uncle. I swam for the Santa Clara Swim Club. I went to a new high school, my junior year of high school. I didn't know anybody at the high school. I learned to drive. I was 16. I learned to drive on the San Jose freeways in a 1954 or 1955 Ford that my dad got all fixed up for me. And I did all this before the Olympics. And from the Santa Clara Swim Club, 8 guys and 8 girls made the Olympic team. So there were 16 of us just from that one swim club that made the Olympic team. We could have been a country all by ourselves, actually, with the medal count after the games of, you know, all the winners. So it was a very elite swim club, and luckily I was a part of it. And I was the sprint backstroker. And So it was a real exciting time for me at the Santa Clara Swim Club because I was able to swim with these other elite swimmers who, there were Olympians who had already been on the 64 team who were swimming in 68. Mark Spitz was on the team, Don Scholander, Pokey Watson had made the Olympic team before. You know, there's just a few that I can remember off the top of my head, but, you know, you're swimming, or I was swimming with Olympians, you know, like I said, right next to me, and it really built my confidence up, because here I was,
sure,
you know, a lone swimmer from West Lane Tennis Club from Stockton, California, and then suddenly, you know, jumping into that international competition, you know, sort of a, it just brought my swimming career up to a higher level.
Now, you'd mentioned kind of going to a new school and not knowing anyone there. Did all the hours of training kind of prevent you from getting to know a lot of people at the school? Were most of your friends from the club?
My social life was at the pool. I did make friends, of course, at the high school. It was Camden High School. My cousin Keith had gone to that same high school, and so, you know, I was familiar with the area, or he, well, actually, he's 6 years older than I am, but it's not like I met any of his friends. It's just that I met a few of the friends there at Camden High School. But again, most of my friends were at Santa Clara.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was difficult because I'd never been to a brand new school before, and I wasn't able to go to the Santa Clara High School, which I originally wanted to go to, because then all of my swimmer friends from Santa Clara Swim Club had, a lot of them went to Santa Clara High School, but my father was a school administrator in Stockton, and he had gone to the superintendent of the Camden High School District and had asked if I could have an interdistrict agreement and go to Santa Clara High School, even though I didn't live in that district.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were just trying to be above board and do everything right, and he declined and said that we couldn't, you know, go to Santa Clara High School because I didn't live there. So that was really frustrating for me because I would have known a lot of people over at Santa Clara High School. So anyway, I did the best I could, and I drove to swim practice before school at about, I don't know, 5:30, get back around 7 o'clock, get ready to go to school, and then after school, I would then get on the freeway and drive over to Santa Clara High School and train for 2 hours, and then come back and drive back to the house in San Jose, and then start the whole day over again. So, you know, it was twice a day training and a lot of driving. And
yeah,
again, I was only 16, so there was a lot of responsibilities that I had, and luckily my parents had a lot of trust in me and thought that I could do it, and gave me the go-ahead to, you know, do the driving and the training all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. When did you realize, like, you had a real shot at making the Olympic team?
Well, I would say the year before the Olympics, when I was at Santa Clara, I was the number one sprint backstroker. So I was on the A relay team that set American records and the relay teams. And going to the national championships, I was coming in second and third. And at the time, I was actually ranked third in the world, so I knew that I had a good chance. And when I was at West Lane Tennis Club before that all kind of blew up and I had to move, my coach, Fred Van Dyke, at the time said, you know, Jane, you really do have a good chance of making the Olympic team in backstroke. And, you know, he was the one who fine-tuned my stroke and got it to where it was very efficient, and so I had the tools and everything to, you know, be able to train well and go fast. So I had the confidence to be able to know that I could do it. And again, when you're ranked certain ways and finish in certain spots at the national level, then you kind of get an idea of who you have to beat and what you have to do in order to make the Olympic team. And actually, making the Olympic team was harder than making the finals at the Olympic Games, because all of the fastest swimmers in the world were Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a scary thing at the Olympic trials, and that was in Los Angeles, and we were swimming at in the 1932 pool where the Olympic Games were held in L.A., of course, the pool had been, you know, redone since 1932. But it was a pretty fast pool, and it was, you know, very exciting. I do remember the week, was it the week or week and a half before, I actually cut my finger and to the bone, and I had to have like 5 stitches in my right hand. And I was just devastated, thinking, oh, no, you know, I don't need to have this happen right before the Olympic trials. But I had stitches put in, and I had to, you know, kind of keep it dry as best I could until I swam, and actually swam, I think I swam with my stitches in. I don't know, but I just kind of had to put that aside and pretend it didn't happen. It didn't hurt anymore anyway, but it just gave me a little bit more time to rest, maybe. Who knows? So, anyway, the Olympic trials were, I don't know. I don't want to say traumatic, but in a way they were. It was just, you just had to make the Olympic team at that time, and that one time, and that one race, at that one point, and you had to do the best you could. So,
sure.
Luckily, I qualified second. They took the top 3 swimmers. Kay Hall finished first. I was second, and Candace Moore from Arizona was third. So, I was, you know, had a spot on the Olympic team, and that was just so exciting to be able to have that happen.
What was kind of the biggest emotion that you felt after qualifying?
What was the biggest emotion?
Yeah.
Relief.
Relief?
It was relief and just accomplishment, knowing that I actually had done this, because it was a dream of mine to be on the Olympic team. Of course, you know, as a young kid, you think, oh, yeah, wouldn't it be great? Well, a lot of people think that, and then it doesn't happen. So for me to have these small goals and reach them, it was amazing. It was very exciting. And to be a part of this group of elite swimmers that, like I say, were just so talented, and again, we could have been our, you know, own country and come in third in the whole Olympics just with our medal count afterwards. So it was a very big confidence boosting element, knowing that you had made the U.S. Olympic team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going into the Olympics to compete against the other, you know, swimmers from other countries. If you were an American swimmer, you had one up on a lot of the other swimmers.
Now, Mexico City was kind of notorious for the high altitude there, and this obviously had a big effect on a lot of track and field athletes. How did it affect swimmers?
Well, I'll tell you, I remember the first day, we went to Colorado Springs for 6 weeks to train in high altitude, and I remember the first day that I had arrived on our training day, Debbie Meyer and I both had nosebleeds. We were really having problems adjusting. We had also, I think we had blood tests where they had to find out how many blood, you know, the blood count before training, and then we had a test afterwards to find out if our blood count had increased, our red blood cells had increased. Of course, I'd never found out the results of those. It would have been kind of interesting to see if there had been a huge increase, but it was interesting because the women's team, I guess you would call us the women's team, so the girls' team, the women's swimmers, we were at the Garden Valley Motel, whereas the men's team was at the Broadmoor, which was this really beautiful resort. So we kind of felt like we were, you know, we didn't get to stay in the nicest place, but it was adequate. And then we would all get in cars, station wagons at the time, and we would drive over to the Air Force Academy and train there, and they had the facilities, you know, for our training, the 50-meter pools, and the cadets were, you know, walking around at the time during school, and we actually were the first women to go to one of the dining halls, so that was sort of a big deal, because they never had let women in there before, and so anyway, that was an interesting part of training at high altitude. Was only the 6 weeks, and, you know, hopefully it worked.
Right. How far in advance was this?
Just 6 weeks.
Okay. So it was the 6 weeks before the Olympics?
Before the games.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I made the Olympic team in August. I think it was August 26th, and then I actually competed on October 23rd. So we were there, I guess, all of September and part of October.
Okay. Now, do you recall anything about the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
No, I don't.
You don't. So you were never contacted by... You know, I know Harvard...
I don't remember being contacted. Again, I might have been, but I don't remember anything about it.
Okay. When you got to Mexico City, what were your first impressions there?
Well, I was going to say, before we got to Mexico City, want me to talk to you a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Well, they were having the student riots from the University of Mexico, and there was a time where we thought we weren't even going to be able to go to the games because of all the rioting, and that was affecting us quite a bit because here we were all ready and prepared and coming down to the, you know, the timeline to where we were going to be going to Mexico City itself, and we were being told that, you know, this was happening, and there were killings, and we're thinking, what the heck? And, you know, there were tanks surrounding the village and shootings, and so we were, you know, really concerned. And then luckily we were given the go-ahead. I guess we had already been told that the track and field athletes were there because they were competing the week prior to us. There was a two-week games, of course, and we were at the end of the game, so the track and field athletes had been there before us. And since they were already there, that was one of the reasons, I guess, why we were going to be competing, or we were going to be arriving, and I guess that would calm down enough to where we could arrive. And then once we got to Mexico City, we were pretty well isolated within the village, the Olympic Village itself, because we weren't able to go anywhere until our event was over. And since my event was towards the end of the games, you know, the only time I could get out of the Olympic Village was to go on the buses to and from the training facilities. So, my impression when I first arrived was a little hazy only because I was just in the village itself. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you ever really worried about security there?
No, I wasn't worried about security. Of course, we had to show our identification wherever we went, but as far as my security, I was never worried about it, no.
Now, you noted staying in the Olympic Village. Could you just talk a little bit more about the accommodations there?
Yeah, we were staying in what they had built for us, which was an apartment complex. So there was a living area, a living room area, and then there were in sort of a circle, and then off of the circle area there were bedrooms. And I was in the living room area with three other swimmers, and they were from Santa Clara, so I knew them. And there were different floors, of course, where we all were staying. So I think on my floor, I think there were mostly Santa Clara swimmers. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of nice. There was, you know, it was kind of bare minimum. And I remember just going up and down the elevator to go to the buses and go to the pool and then come back. And then they had the, of course, the dining rooms were allotted for the different countries. And I remember eating at the dining rooms for the Americans and looking around, and I noticed that there were a lot of Japanese athletes in our line, and I actually spoke to one of them and, you know, asked them why they were in our dining room, and they said because they wanted to eat the same food that we ate since we were so much taller and stronger than their athletes, and that they wanted to be more like the American athletes. And I thought, oh, that was kind of interesting, only because I think that there was different food flown in for different countries for them to eat. I do remember there was a lot of very thin steak, and I think it was from the bullfights, I hate to tell you. It was probably, you know, flank steak or thin steaks from the bulls. But it was fine from what I remember. It wasn't that bad. One thing that was bad, though, was bottled water. It was a concern, and so we had to make sure that we drank from, you know, certain water bottles. And then I remember looking out of the window in my dorm and looking down, and there was a worker with a big bottle of a huge, you know, bottle from the tap, the faucet, pouring water into it. So that was our bottled water. It was straight from the tap. And I did lose 8 pounds right before I swam during that 2-week period because of Montezuma's Revenge. So there were quite a lot of us who got sick.
How did that affect your swimming? Or your training?
Well, of course, I could say if I hadn't lost the weight, I would have won my gold medal. Instead, I won a bronze. But no, I'm sure it weakened us all. It wasn't the most ideal place for the Olympics. First of all, it's a high altitude, and then, of course, the food was so different in the water. It just, we just had to do the best we could with what we had.
Now, you mentioned living with 3 other swimmers. Who were they?
It was Lynn Vidali, Pokey Watson, and Jan Henney. And they were from, from Santa Clara.
Okay. Now, what were your memories and experiences of the opening ceremony?
Oh, yeah, that was so exciting. That was very memorable. I think one of my biggest memories was then walking through the tunnel into the stadium and the cheers going up for the American team. And just being so proud to be an American and standing there and walking all the way around the whole track and then going into the section where we were going to be standing, it was kind of, awe-inspiring. I mean, it was sort of a psych-up for your race.
Sure.
To be a part of this whole historic event. And being able to take it all in and just to kind of breathe it and know that you are a part of it was just exciting. One thing they didn't tell us, though, when they released the doves, is that you should have had some newspapers over your heads because these poor doves were cooped up for quite a long time. And so that was one little kind of crazy thing where the athletes were running around trying to dodge from the doves flying around. But it was pretty exciting is all I can kind of sum up.
Do you remember where you were standing in the formation?
I do remember. In fact, when I look at that picture that was taken of the women's team, I know exactly what was happening at the moment the picture was taken, because on our parade uniform, we had Olympic rings on our shoes. I think it was the white patent shoes or the blue patent shoes or the white patent shoes. Don't remember which color they were, but I do remember they had the pewter Olympic rings on them, and I was looking down at my shoe because my Olympic rings were starting to kind of fall off, or they were twisted, or they were askew, and I was mentioning to somebody, I said, oh yeah, look at my rings are coming off, and I looked down. So when I look at that picture, I'm looking down, and I go, oh yeah, I remember exactly.
No kidding.
What was happening. Luckily the rings didn't come off, but that was what I was thinking when that happened. And I was on the end. I was on the side. So I remember walking in that formation, and I was sort of in the middle on the last row on the left side. And I wasn't in the middle of the group, so I had more of a open vision of the field and things.
Now, was there anyone on the team with whom you were particularly close?
Well, I think that all of the Santa Clara swimmers were pretty close. There were 8 of us who were from the same swim team who had trained together, and then we all made the Olympic team together, and so we all had that camaraderie and that bond. So I would say, all of the swimmers, all 8 of us were really pretty close.
Sure. Did you have much interaction with athletes from other national teams?
I did. I actually exchanged some items with Vladimir Bure from Russia. He wanted, I think he wanted a swimsuit for his sister, and I exchanged, I think it was a little sweatshirt or something that had USA on it, and in return, I got a block of chocolate that was all written in Russian, which is kind of exciting. In fact, I still have it, if you can believe it. It's kind of turned white, kind of funny color, but I have it locked away in one of my trunks. And then I got a little wooden fisherman that had been carved out, and and of course the nesting dolls. I got a couple of those also from him, so that was kind of nice. And I also made friends with some Australian swimmers. One of them happened to be a guy, and I actually wrote to him for quite a few years after the Olympics. And when I went over to Australia, I went over and met him again, and I met his family, and I saw, you know, the address where I had written to him for, I don't know, it must have been 5 years after the game. So I did make some lasting friendships with people.
Now, also, there was some gender verification testing in 1968. Were you aware of this?
Yes, I was, mostly because before we left for Mexico City, we had to take a sex test, and we were all lined up outside of this room, and we had to go into this room, and we had no idea what was going to happen to us. And so the girls who were ahead of us, ahead of me or whatever, would come out and go, "Oh my gosh, you're not going to believe what's going to happen when you go in there." And we're like, "Oh no." And so we went inside, and they opened, they said, "Please open your mouth." And they took a toothpick and scraped the inside of our mouth for, you know, DNA cells for the cheek and our cheeks. And so, of course, when we left the room to go out again, we go, "Oh my gosh, you're just never going to know it. You're never going to believe what's going to happen in there." So we were aware that they were, you know, testing us to find out if we were men or women. And then another incident was, I remember being in the Olympic Village, and I was walking with Greg Buckingham at the time. He was also a Santa Clara swimmer. And there was a Czechoslovakian shot putter who happened to be up on one of the grassy knolls in the, I could say, in the Olympic Village. And Greg Buckingham was about 6'4", 200 pounds. He was really a good-sized guy. And he said, "Okay, Jane, I'm going to go stand up next to, you know, that person over there. Now you tell me, you know, who's bigger, if I'm bigger than she is." And he came back and I said, "Nope, she was bigger." And I remember there was a huge controversy over that. I think it was that, actually, that person, or there was a Czechoslovakian or somebody who was not, they weren't sure if she was a man or a woman. And that's a good thing to follow up on to find out what happened about that. But anyway, we were all aware of that. And, of course, there were, you know, the East Germans were rather large for the women. But then again, the American swimmers, we weren't exactly petite. So, you know, we were aware that people, or that, you know, we were having to go through the testing. And, you know, that's all. We, you know, we weren't given the results, obviously, if we passed the test. But, you know, it was because of the other, of the iron block countries that we were concerned about, mm-hmm. mostly track and field.
Now, moving to your event specifically, could you just kind of talk about what it was and where was it held?
Sure. Well, it was held at the swim stadium, and there were 32 swimmers in my actual event, the 100-meter backstroke. So we had to swim in the trials to make the semifinals, and then from the semifinals, or from the trials, they took 16 to swim in the semifinals. And then, so we swam that in the same day, the trials in the morning, I believe the semifinals in the afternoon. And then from the semifinals, they took the top eight to swim in the finals for the next day. So I had qualified, I believe, you know, third all along, and then for the final, I was qualified third, and Kay Hall had qualified second, and the Canadian Elaine Tanner had qualified first, and she had been talking to the press about how there was no competition, and it was really going to be easy, and, you know, all this stuff, and she had beaten Kay Hall before, and so, and, you know, she was kind of had a real kind of a cavalier attitude about it and just thought, no big deal. So Kay and I talked to each other and said, "Okay, I don't care which one of us does it, but one of us has to beat her." And as it turned out, of course, Kay Hall beat her, and in a world record time. So it was amazing. It was really close between first and second, between Kay Hall and Elaine Tanner. And then it was very close between me, who got third, and Candace Moore, who was from the United States, who got fourth. So first and second were really close, and then they, you know, luckily they had the touch pads. They had just introduced the touch pads in the swimming events for that Olympic Games, but they also had backup timers, and they had backup judges also. So anyway, I did come in third, and that was just so exciting, but I really wasn't sure until they put it up on the score board whether or not I'd gotten third or not. So when I came walking back to my coach after I got out of the pool, and I said, "Oh, you know, did I get, I think I got third, didn't I, George?" And he said, because George was actually the men's Olympic coach for the 68 at the time, and he was there, and he said, I'm not sure, you know, because I was looking at somebody who had gotten sixth. I knew I'd beaten her, but I thought that that person was fourth, when it turns out that she really wasn't fourth, she was sixth. So anyway, it was very, you know, satisfying, and I'm so glad it was over when my maid came up third. And so then we had to go in and have, we had some, like orange juice to recover ourselves, and then we had to walk all the way around the pool deck, and I do know that there were a couple, I do know one for sure, not in my race, but in another race, one of the guys actually fainted walking around because of the high altitude and the race and the whole thing. So anyway, after the medal ceremony, which was very exciting, and my father and my mother were there, and my father filmed the whole thing. He had a 16-millimeter camera and opened the lens all the way up. It was an indoor, stadium, but he had outdoor film, but it turned out fine. And he got the whole race and the ceremony on movies. So he watched my race through the camera, and then he watched the award ceremony through the camera. So I'm not quite sure how he was able to do that, but he did. And but anyway, I have that. I'm just really excited to have that as part of my treasures. And then after we had our award ceremony, we had to go immediately into this little room for drug testing. And that was a whole other experience, because I couldn't go to the bathroom, and they were taking urine samples, and I just couldn't go. I was rather excited, and I just couldn't go. So anyway, so this woman, she actually follows me into the little bathroom there, and I'm having to try to go to the bathroom with this woman watching me for fear that I would, tamper with the sample in any way. Well, anyway, the next time I went back to try, I was fine. But during the meantime, my parents were waiting for me outside the room, and I remember walking out with I had my swimsuit on, and I had my medal around my neck, and they said, "Oh, are you ready to go?" And I go, "No, I can't go." And they were going, "Oh my God!" So, and I do remember some officials, Olympic officials, actually had followed somebody around the Olympic Village, because they weren't able to go to the bathroom either, and they kept with them day and night until the person finally went. So it was a big deal that you actually had to have a urine sample before anybody would leave you alone.
Mm-hmm. So going back to the moment on the medal stand and kind of listening to the national anthem, mm-hmm. And getting your medal awarded, just talk about kind of the emotion there.
Well, I was lucky in that Kay Hall was from the United States and won the gold medal, so they played the Star Spangled Banner. So of course, they were playing it for me too. And when I was up there, and I'll never forget this feeling, it felt like the sun was shining from my stomach. It felt like, it kind of sounds strange, but it just was this glow and this strength and this satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
And God, I'm getting a little emotional just thinking about it, just talking about it again. But it just, I had tears streaming down my face, and just realizing that, gosh, I actually did this. And
I mean, it's something not a lot of people can say they've done.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess I was living the experience, knowing that I had accomplished what I wanted to do, which was so hard to do. And it was just an amazing feeling. I've never felt that feeling ever again. It was just, it's something that you kind of wish you could get back,
mm-hmm.
but it's just, that was it. And it was just amazing. The downside to that was the next morning, because, I did sleep with my medal around my neck, too. I have to admit, I did sleep with it. And then the next day, kind of walking around the village thinking, oh, my God, what am I going to do now? It was like, uh-oh, it's over, but it was sort of it was a very strange feeling, the realization that I had accomplished it. And then you're kind of in a vacuum.
Right.
Yeah.
Given kind of the quality of the U.S. swimmers, was there an expectation to win? Or was there a pressure?
Was there pressure for me personally to win or for the Americans to win?
I guess both, within the team.
Well, yeah, I think we were expected to win, only because, you know, I hate to say it, but we had the majority of world records. We were top in the world. So, yeah, we were expected to do well. And then when we did and we came through, it was even more exciting and more satisfying. So, like I said before, when you as an American swimmer coming into that race, I already had an advantage, you know, because all the other swimmers knew that we had done these particular times and that we had accomplished certain things and that we were from the United States, and that was kind of scary to them, I think. So it was a huge, like I say, a huge confident builder.
Now, kind of turning back to the drug testing, you noted being tested. Were any of your teammates tested as well?
All the medal winners were tested, yeah.
Okay.
Every single one of them.
What about any non-medal winners on your team?
Not that I know of. No, I think at that time, that might have been the first time they even did the drug testing. I don't believe they did in 64. I could be wrong, but as I remember, it was all kind of new. In fact, we were given vitamins like the week before, like the first week of the games, and then they were told, don't take any more vitamins, don't take anything at all, aspirin, nothing, don't take anything, you know, the second week of the games, which were when the swimming started. So we were told, you know, just be really careful not to do anything. And I'd taken vitamins all my life. You know, my dad had always made sure that I had my vitamins and ate my vegetables and all those things. But at the Olympics themselves, you know, there were things that we were told, and you just make sure, you just be careful. So.
Now, moving forward into the Tommy Smith and John Carlos silent gesture, did you witness it?
No, I don't think I did. I know I didn't. I just saw it on TV. Probably, I may have witnessed it at the Olympics, in the Olympic Village, or a videotape of it afterwards. Because we were isolated. The swimmers were, you know, in the Olympic Village until we swam, and we were at the very end. So the track and field was first, and then, you know, the swimming was later.
What was your reaction when you did see it?
Well, I'll tell you, I was a little bit embarrassed, and I was, I really had felt that, you know, I know that they had their reasons, obviously, for their own personal reasons for doing it, but as an Olympian, I felt that they encroached on other Olympians' rights, and they were, you know, I know that there were meetings beforehand with the black community or black athletes, and Harry Edwards had gathered them all there to talk to them about whether or not they were going to be protesting or not. And a lot of the other black athletes didn't want to protest. And so for John Carlos and Tommy Smith to go ahead and do that, you know, I know it took a lot of guts on their part to do it, but again, you know, I just felt it was the wrong place to do it, in the fact that it stepped on my rights as an Olympian and my rights as an athlete, because the Olympic Games are there for the athletes to gather in peace and to come to harmony and to compete with, you know, no conflicts and things, no political aspirations within the games, and they breached that contract, and I just felt that they should have done it at another time in another place.
What was the reaction of the people around you?
We were all kind of horrified and just thought, oh my gosh, now what's going to happen? You know, it was... I do remember speaking to one of the boxers. I think it was Ronaldo Brown, And he, along with like George Foreman, you know, they were not happy with what happened either. And so it was just sort of a, I want to say a quietness or kind of a, you know, you look at other athletes, you just kind of hope that they weren't going to bring it up and talk to you about it because you didn't really know what to say.
Now, in terms of media, were you able to interact with any journalists?
Yeah, after our race, the medalists then sat down to a press conference, and so we were interviewed, you know, by the press. And I remember one of the journalists asked me about whether or not I was related to Keith Swaggerty, who actually is my cousin, who I mentioned earlier. I lived with his parents in San Jose. He was actually a professional basketball player, and he played for the ABA at the time for the Kentucky Colonels, and then he actually played in Italy also. So I remember one of the journalists asked me about that and about the Santa Clara Swim Club, being a part of that. And then I do remember Elaine Tanner, who got second, who was boasting about how there was no competition, how she was kind of quiet, and how Kay Hall was very excited and happy for winning the gold medal.
Now, I know the swimming events came later on in the games. Were you able to attend any other sports?
The only other events I believe I saw was volleyball. And they were in the same stadium area. They were connected to the swim stadium. They were right next to us. So I saw some volleyball events. But I don't believe I was able to see really any other events just because, you know, we had to concentrate on our race so much.
Sure.
We were able to go outside the village after our event was over, and I remember going to the floating gardens of Xochimilco, and my parents were there in Mexico City, so I was able to go with them afterwards. We went, actually, I wasn't with my parents, but I remember the swimmers. We went to the market, go shopping as a team, you know, things like that. But we weren't able to really go too many places only because, you know, we'd been waiting for our events. My parents were able to tour around and got to go to a lot of places, and so that was fun for them.
Mm-hmm. Looking back, what was the most memorable part? Obviously, the medal is a big deal.
Yeah, I think winning my medal was the most memorable part, and being able to just appreciate the 2 weeks and absorb as much as I could. And I do remember, you know, meeting the other athletes. That was really fun for me too, you know, interacting with them, and everybody had pins to exchange, and so you know, you wanted to get different pins from other countries, or you could exchange your the clothes that were given to you from the Olympic team, but then again, you wanted to keep some of those for your own keepsake. So there were some things that you didn't want to trade. But I just think the whole, you know, the International Center at the Olympic Village, where you could, you know, there were free Cokes and, you know, free newspapers and things like that, where everyone could kind of gather and hang around. And then the dining rooms were kind of interesting to see other athletes. And I remember there was 7'2" Russian basketball players. That was a real big deal because they were so tall at the time. Nobody was over, you know, 7 feet at all. I remember my dad getting a picture of him, or the movies of him walking by in the background, and it just stood out so much as being so tall. And just, I don't know, I think, again, the medal stands out as the most exciting and most memorable, but just the experience of the actual Olympic Games and being part of the Olympic team was such a honor and a privilege, and to have earned it was just so satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to participate in the closing ceremony at all?
Well, no. I didn't. It turns, you know, they had told us that the athletes were going to have to sit up in the stands and watch the closing ceremonies, and they were only going to choose a few people to walk down below. And I just thought, well, I think I'd rather watch it in the Olympic Village with other athletes. Mm-hmm. So that's really what happened, is I watched it on TV with the some other athletes. And actually, the Australian guy I mentioned, Rob Cusack from Australia, he was there too. And so we were just kind of hanging out, watching it on TV. And then when everybody kind of bolted and jumped over the stands and ran onto the field, we all thought that was kind of interesting. But we were fine being able to, you know, stay at the Village. It was sort of our last evening, you know, in Mexico. I believe we left the next day, you know, to fly back to L.A. and then to our various hometowns.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't have a chance to stick around after the games at all and kind of...
No, I had to go back to school.
Okay. And what was the reaction in your hometown when you got back?
Well, as I mentioned before, I had gone away my junior year of high school to live with my aunt and uncle in San Jose, and so my senior year I came back to Stockton to finish out my senior year of high school. And I missed September and October, so I missed 2 months of school. So when I came back, they had a big greeting, and they had Jane Swaggerty Day, and they had a big old rally with the whole school there. And, you know, it was very exciting, and it was really fun to be back, you know, to see my friends that I, you know, hadn't seen for that last year. There were a few things that were a little bit different, because I would be walking down the hall and I would hear somebody whisper, "There goes Jane Swaggerty, there goes Jane Swaggerty." And I'd think, wait a minute, but I'm still the same person. You know, I wasn't different in my mind, but I think people saw me differently because I'd been on TV, I'd been at the Olympics, and I'd been gone, and suddenly I was, you know, back in school, you know, trying to fit in just like a normal person. And also, it was also during the time when girl athletes weren't supposed to be better than guy athletes. You know, women hadn't come into their own as far as athletics, and you weren't supposed to have, you know, bigger muscles than guys. You weren't supposed to be better athletes. And so I really wanted to kind of blend in, and I didn't really, you know, want to, I didn't want to have anyone think that I was bragging in any way, so I just really downplayed my Olympic stuff as best I could. And I think that's it's a true outlook on the female athlete in the 60s, because we weren't given really the same kudos as guys.
Mm-hmm.
And yet here I'd gone to the Olympics, won a medal, and yet it couldn't even be on a girls' swim team because they didn't have one.
So speaking of which, when you did get back, did you continue swimming?
Well, when I came back, I did continue swimming in Stockton for a while. I had a real tragedy happen in our family. I came back in November, and then in March of 1969, my younger brother was killed in a bicycle accident.
I'm very sorry.
Yeah, it was very traumatic, and I was sort of at a crossroads. I really didn't know what I should be doing. Again, that same feeling of the day after I swam was sort of like, oh, my God, what am I going to do now? And I was thinking, okay, now, you know, I got to go on for another 4 years. My senior year, I've got to go into college. Where do I swim? There are no women's scholarships. And then my brother was killed, and it was sort of a very difficult time for our family. And I was, my brother was in college up in Oregon, and my sister was living in Connecticut, so I was really the only one left at home. And we had an exchange student living with us from Australia at the time also. So for me to continue swimming, it just wasn't in the cards as far as I could see. But my parents had asked me, they said, well, if I stayed home my freshman year of college and went to a junior college, then they would send me to Europe for the summer for, like, I think it was like 3 weeks. I was going to be traveling around, And that way I could get readjusted to everything and I would be home. And so I did that. I stayed home my freshman year of college and went to junior college. And then I did swim in junior college, but it was, you know, it was just for fun. I rarely trained and, you know, it was just, I didn't want any pressure. When I look back at it, I kind of wish that I'd gone on to Arizona State University. They did have a women's swim program there. But the person who got fourth in my event, Candace Moore, actually was swimming at the time. And I thought, oh gosh, if I swim on the swim team, I'm going to have to compete against her all the time. And I didn't want that competition so much right after the games. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It just sort of, I just wanted to relax and not worry about my swimming so much. And again, I was going through the trauma of my brother not being around and having to adjust to that, and so it was really hard for me to, you know, refocus and to reset any goals. So I then ended up transferring my sophomore year to school up where my older brother went to school, which was Southern Oregon College, and they did have a girls' swim team. There were no scholarships, of course, but it was just for fun, and I did swim up there. And I was, my brother was up there, so it was around family, and that was up in Ashland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. So then after that, I basically retired. You know, so that was like 1970 is when I stopped swimming.
Mm-hmm.
But my coach, George Haynes, at the time said, you know, if, looking back, of course, he was saying, you know, if you'd swim another 4 years, you would have made the team and, you know, would have been able to, you know, of course, he said I would have won it, but who knows, but, you know, that's water under the bridge. But, again, I only could do what I could do at the time, and that was all I could do.
Mm-hmm. How do you think your life would have been different if you hadn't been an Olympic athlete?
Oh, that's a good question. You mean if I had swum all those years and not make the Olympic team?
Or, you know, not
even... Or done something else? Or?
Yeah, either or, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I majored in commercial art and advertising, and I got the same satisfaction of completing a project that I did when I would win a race or do well in a race. So I know that I would have... pursued that even more if I hadn't made the Olympic team. I would have probably put my energy more into that. And if I hadn't, if I had swum all those years and then missed the Olympic team, it would have been pretty frustrating. I think I would have known that I wasn't going to make the Olympic team, and I would have stopped swimming probably when I was like 15 or so or 14. You know, there's sort of a time in a young girl's life where, you know, when you're 13 or 14, you make a decision. Either you're going to do something or you're not, if you have the abilities to do it. And I don't know what my life would have been like, because, again, the Olympics have been such a part of me from such a young age. It's hard to... you know what it was like, would be like without it, even though I did sort of downplay it for a good 10 years after the game.
Mm-hmm. Now you were quite young when you competed. Was that typical for swimmers?
Well, I think so. Yeah, I was only 17, and I remember going to events afterwards. You know, like they would invite Olympians to go to special events, and, you know, openings of... oh, gosh, I'm trying to think of what they would be. I can't remember. But well, actually, Debbie Meyer and I opened up a swimming complex at an apartment building, you know, that kind of a thing, just a, kind of a fun thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or we would be invited to be guest speakers at, businesses or something. And so that was always, you know, something that was bringing the Olympics back. That, you know, every 4 years they would say, oh, yeah, now isn't there Jane Swaggerty? Isn't she around here somewhere? Let's find her. And then I'd be in the newspaper, and I would talk about how what it was like in the Olympics. So every 4 years, you know, it would happen again, which was kind of nice to kind of, you know, know that I was remembered and not forgotten, because it has been quite a few years. But I remember the being someplace with Debbie Meyer and Chris Von Salza, and Chris Von Salza competed at the 1960 Olympics, and I don't remember how many golds she got. I know she got at least two. And she was a huge swimming icon. We all looked up to her, and she ended up being our chaperone on the 68 Olympic team. And the three of us were at an event, and we all were talking about how it took us 10 years for us to actually say in a conversation that we were in the Olympic Games and actually won a medal. Because in a conversation, if some, like if well, mostly around guys, it would never, I would never bring it up, or I would never say, oh yeah, the Olympics, oh, well, I actually won a medal. You know, I would never have said that. I would never have brought that up. Whereas now, today, heck, I will say it now. If it comes up in the conversation, I'll certainly, you know, say it. But it was a time where it was just different.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a whole different feeling, and it's not like I wasn't proud of it. It just, I just didn't want people to think that I was bragging about it, I guess. You know, it was really a strange a line there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that there were other females like me. Like I said, I know for sure Debbie and Chris were feeling that. I'm sure all the others, some of the other swimmers were too. In fact, I do know of a swimmer who won a gold, a silver, and a bronze medal, and I asked her about them. I said, well, where are they? And she goes, oh, they're in a closet.
No kidding.
You know, I was like, what? They're in your closet? At least mine's framed and it's in my office. But, you know, some people just, you know, that's a part of their life, then they just move on and something else, you know, and it's referred to off and on, but it's just different for, it was just different for a female athlete.
What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
So an Olympic hopeful meaning that they haven't made the Olympic team yet?
Right.
Well, I would probably say just do the best that you can at the time, because that one moment that you have to make the Olympic team has to be that moment that you make it. You may have been your best a week before or a week after, but that one day you have to be the best you are in order to make the Olympic team. And I guess you really can't beat yourself up if you don't make it, because you've done your best and you've tried your hardest. That's really all that I would give as advice, because, you know, there's really nothing else you can say except, you know, try
mm-hmm.
your hardest. And then for those who have made the Olympic or who make or going to be making the Olympic team and you're at the Olympics, my advice for them would be just absorb as much as you can, and don't just, you know, you do have to concentrate on your race, but also take in everything around you and absorb it, because it goes by so quickly. And I do remember standing there and taking in as much as I could, and I was so glad I did, because I'm able to remember quite a few things of what happened, you know, in the village or in the dining hall or, you know, just here and there in the pool. I can go back exactly know where I was at certain times, you know, on the buses or, you know, just things that you don't want to take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my best advice would be to do the best you can, and hopefully you've trained and you've got everything lined up to where you're going to do what you can.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And I did want to give you the last word if there was anything else that you wanted to add.
No, I don't think so. It's just that it's been, the Olympics have been a real special part of who I am, in that I knew that I could do whatever I put my mind to, and that that I can always fall back on that and have that confidence of knowing that. I don't think at 17 though, I don't think I had the confidence that I have now, and that could be with age, but the Olympics is just something that many, many athletes strive to achieve, and not very many people are able to accomplish it and have those experiences. So I do realize it's very special, and And yet, and one other thing, when the Olympics do come up in a conversation, it's kind of interesting because some people will be very, complimentary and say, "Oh my gosh, that's so exciting!" And you know, I'm really happy and you know, proud that you were able to do that. And then other people will just kind of ignore it and pretend that you didn't say it because they don't believe you. So I find that kind of interesting that, you know, you fit in as an Olympian now, so many years later, you fit into, you know, society, but yet you always know in the back of your mind that you've done something very special.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good feeling.
Great. And on that note, I just wanted to thank you for your time and your willingness to participate in this project.
Okay, well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.